3. Keys to the Kingdom. February 2010 through February 2012. When Christian Rodriguez flew to New York in February 2010, the Russian seemed as promised. He was a man with simple needs and a suitcase full of money. If he looked a little menacing with his scowl and leather jacket, it was how those people were. The two men's business was conducted quickly, their conversation technical in nature. Rodriguez had brought along an off-the-shelf encryption system, not quite a generic model, but nothing fancy either, a standard product that any businessman might use if he was traveling and wanted to speak securely with the office. To the casual listener, their meeting would have sounded much like what it was, one man selling technology to another in a hotel room high above Times Square. Rodriguez showed the Russian how the system worked, press Alt-A, now hit 7, and how to configure the cell phones he was buying. A few delicate issues were discussed, but only to establish bona fides. The Russian said that he and his partners mainly worked domestically, moving merchandise from one state to another, a fine operation, but much more modest than the technician's other customers, if he had his facts straight. Cautiously but audibly, Rodriguez admitted that the Russian's facts were straight enough. He had indeed done work for the drug lord, Chapo Guzman. Sitting in the suite next door, Marston and Patash had him. The camera and bug mic hidden in the Russian's room had caught it all on tape. Throughout the meeting, the agents had been tuned in live through the audio feed and monitor, fascinated to have heard Rodriguez confirm his connection to the kingpin and to have gotten their first real glimpse of a man who until then had only been a shadow. The two men arrived at similar conclusions, that Operation Server Jack might actually work and that Christian Rodriguez, while certainly a genius, wasn't much to look at. Then, as they sat watching, the target they had tracked for months took his money and walked out the door. It had always been the plan to let him go. While Marston and Patash now had the means to charge Rodriguez with aiding and abetting, maybe even with conspiracy, the higher-ups at C-23 were of the opinion that a hard sell wasn't possible. If they had stormed the room, threatening indictments, it would have likely spooked the young man and kept them from their ultimate goal of getting him to turn on Chapo Guzman. A formal arrest would have also required going public with his name, which would have placed Rodriguez in extraordinary danger and risked alerting the kingpin that they were onto him as well. It wasn't easy watching Rodriguez leave, but Marston and Patash knew that they were closing in on their prize, the keys to the kingdom, as they had started calling it. Better to hang back, the squad's more reasonable minds advised, and lie in wait for a sounder opportunity. Hanging back might have been easier if there had been some progress on the technical end, but whenever the agents made another call to ERF, they got the same answer. Almost, but not yet. Marston and Batash didn't know how many times they had driven down to Quantico by now. While they couldn't blame the techs, it was maddening to hear that they didn't know much more about the Nokia at this point than they did on the first day they had had it. Hacking into the server had also hit a wall. The IP address was still a moving target, flitting from place to place with no discernible pattern. Even worse, every time that ERF thought it had a way into the system, the components seemed to change. First, the phones on the network had been upgraded from E71s to E72s. Then the server itself had changed, or rather, other servers had been added to the system. There was one on the network that now appeared to have been designed for BlackBerries. No one knew what that meant. The associate was able to shed a little light on it. In speaking with Rodriguez, he had heard a whisper about some sort of spying or surveillance project. It wasn't quite clear what this project was, but it seemed to be a kind of internal security effort that Guzman put in place to monitor his people. Other than that, most of what the associate was offering were random little tips about where Rodriguez was going, what he had been doing, and how he was feeling about his job with Guzman. Though he hadn't been to the mountains in months, he was still employed by the Kingpin on safe ground in Colombia. With Rodriguez at home and ERF's tech team at a standstill, Marston and Patash reassessed. They were still collecting everything they could about Rodriguez and took what they could get, or whatever judges gave them with a warrant, rooting around in the young technician's emails and sifting through his purchases on Amazon. But even though they knew Rodriguez had developed Guzman's network, they were not persuaded that he was the best or the only source who could help them crack it. After scratching at the edges of the young man's circles, the agents had stumbled onto two more possibilities. The Kingpin's other techies, El Gordo and his partner, Charlie Martinez. Marston and Patash started digging into their lives too, with the same assiduous attention they had lavished on Rodriguez, all the while hoping that the techs at Quantico would finally come through. At least there weren't any naysayers now. After their coup with the Russian, their colleagues, who had formerly been skeptical, started showing interest. Had they approached the kid yet? Did they think that they could flip him? Could he really get them into Guzman's system? The secret network, once dismissed as myth, was developing a buzz. Within the Bureau and beyond, Operation Server Jack had suddenly grown legs. But with the legs came debates and disagreements. There were, as always in the government, certain elements with differing opinions about how they ought to handle the case. Some of them were not inclined to take the gradual approach and sit back waiting for the proper moment in which to educate the young Mr. Rodriguez about the benefits of FBI cooperation. 1 month after C-23 had lured Rodriguez to Manhattan, a hit team in Juarez had gunned down a pregnant American consulate worker and her husband in what seemed to be the latest atrocity in Guzman's war of conquest on the border. If the secret cell phone system was indeed what Marston and Patash said it was, the Kingpin's communications lifeblood, indispensable to his trafficking operation, then why hinge everything on a 20-year-old kid? Why not take a more forward course of action and shut the system down with a colossal denial-of-service attack, blasting Guzman and his Nokias back to the Stone Age? With the keys to the kingdom in the balance, Marston and Patash cautiously pushed back. It was not as if the Kingpin's network had a kill switch they could flip, and even if there was a switch somewhere, they didn't know exactly where or how it worked, or who could help them find it, except perhaps for Christian Rodriguez. Moreover, and in a separate vein, what was likely to happen, they argued, if Guzman woke one morning and found a 404 error flickering on the screen of his phone? Experience and their own investigation suggested he would just go out and hire a new brilliant techie to build him a new brilliant system, and then they would be back at square one. The whole thing was starting to take a toll. Patash found himself consumed by mysterious anxieties. Something, he felt, anything could happen now to screw up their investigation. The Colombians might learn about Rodriguez and arrest him, or Guzman himself might get arrested, even killed. Neutralizing the Kingpin was the point of the operation, but Patash couldn't bear the thought of someone else making the caller or never getting to hear the conversations passing through the Nokias. In the mornings, as soon as he got out of bed, he rushed to his computer and nervously checked Google, wondering if months of work had already gone down the drain. It was only after he had entered his search terms, El Chapo, captured, dead, and nothing popped up, that he relaxed. These were hardly idle worries. Throughout the spring and summer of 2010, as the Juarez corridor exploded into an orgy of car bombs, kidnappings, and mass assassinations, the authorities from Mexico to Argentina rounded up several cartel leaders close to Guzman. Among the first to go was Luis Don Lucho Caicedo, who was captured in Buenos Aires in April. Don Lucho, it was alleged, had shipped nearly 900 tons of Colombian cocaine to American consumers, much of it through Guzman's private smuggling routes. A few months later, the Mexican army killed the Kingpin's number three man, Ignacio Nacho Coronel in a shootout in Jalisco. In September, the Beltran Leyva brothers' blonde-haired, American-born security chief, Edgar La Barbie Valdez, was picked up at a house in Mexico City less than a year after tipping off the Mexican Marines to the location of his former boss, Arturo Beltran Leyva. Even as Marston and Potash strategized about how and when to buttonhole Rodriguez, their colleagues in the Bureau's Boston office were deep into their own secret sting against the kingpin. Posing as Sicilian gangsters, agents in New England had set in motion Operation Dark Water, a covert plot to capture Guzman, moving crates of Peruvian cocaine to a port in southern Spain in a cover load of pineapples. Not only had they sent an informant to the mountains to get the effort started, they were this close to convincing Guzman to come down from his hideout and personally quality check the deal at an airfield near Madrid, at which point they were going to grab him. In the end, what pushed the New York agents into action was another competing case, the one being run in part by their old friends from the DEA in Bogota. In November 2010, Bogota's work on the Cifuentes family found its way into a federal indictment in Miami. For the first time, it was revealed in public that the U.S. government was investigating Jorge, Dolly, and Alex. The charging document, which reached back to Pacho's early days in 2003, was exceedingly comprehensive. There were seizure dates, aliases for each of the defendants, and dozens of meticulously detailed financial transactions routed through American banks, amounting to millions of dollars. It all suggested that DEA Bogota and their partners in Miami had some time ago inserted an endoscope deep into the bowels of the family's organization. The American indictment, based on a wiretap, was an existential threat, and the Cifuentes siblings and many of those around them started getting nervous. Just before the charges were announced, Jorge fled to Venezuela, grew a beard, and hid out in a small town near Caracas, moving in with a family of local farmers. Even the more reasonable minds at C-23 decided it was finally time to hit the gas on Operation Server Jack. They had no choice but to get Rodriguez now, before he and 100 other Colombians went underground. They turned again to the associate. Over the course of several months, the agent's secret source had already done much for them. In his far-flung meetings with Marston and Potash, he had taken orders to coax Rodriguez into sitting with the Russian, kept his handlers apprised of their subject's movements, and provided them with the initial proof of concept phone. Now, the associate was going to deliver the technician to the FBI's front door. Shortly after February 14th, the associate prevailed on Rodriguez to fly to Bogota. The purpose of the trip was to have him met there, by surprise, by the men who had been trailing him since 2009. Potash had picked the date himself. It would not have been wise, he reasoned, with the ungodly hours he had been working, to be out of the country on Valentine's Day and risk further pissing off his wife. Bogota's El Dorado Airport has a busy pickup zone for taxis just beyond the sliding glass doors outside arrivals. That was where Marston and Potash, joined by one of their colleagues from the embassy, waited for Rodriguez as shortly after 8 in the morning on February 21st, 2011. When the young man stepped outside, two local uniformed policemen approached him flashing badges. They told Rodriguez to come with them, please, and placed them into a car parked at the curb. It was one of the smallest cars that the Americans standing nearby had ever seen. Potash went first, climbing in through the back door on the passenger side. No doubt shocked to see a gringo in the car, Rodriguez started sliding toward the driver's side and was met by the agent from the embassy, sliding in beside him. In the crowded back seat, Potash pulled his own badge out and introduced himself as an American federal agent. He told Rodriguez they needed to talk and asked for his permission to take him somewhere quiet. When Rodriguez, looking ashen, nervously assented. Potash asked his hosts if they could find a place nearby for a private conversation. They ended up at a seedy motel a few blocks from the airport. No one had to show ID, and they paid the clerk in cash. Rodriguez took a seat inside on an armchair across from the couch and coffee table. The room was small, not much bigger than the car outside, and the agents squeezed around their subject. All of them avoided going anywhere near the bed. The pitch by the Americans was candid and direct. They knew who Rodriguez was, they said, what he had been doing, and exactly who he'd done it for. They also knew that he wasn't really a criminal. He had just fallen in with the wrong crowd. Marston and Potash played to the young man's image of himself. He ran a business, needed money. It was perfectly understandable. But the sort of people he was dealing with, they quietly assured him, were not the sort of people that he wanted to be dealing with, not if he was interested in living into his 30s. To be clear, he understood that they were serious. They showed a few cards. Charlie Martinez, the man he had trained to run the network in his absence? Yes, they were aware of him. Rodriguez seemed most comfortable when Potash talked to him about the servers and encryption keys. That made sense. Then it wasn't simply about the kilos and the killings. It was about technology. When they brought things to a point, the business of cooperation, Rodriguez was in a kind of trance, staring at the embassy agent's sidearm tucked into the holster at his shoulder. The agent was leaning forward like the rest of them, hands on knees, waiting for an answer, his service pistol swaying back and forth like a hypnotist's pendant. Someone was telling Rodriguez it was time to come on board, time to make a decision. He should help them, help himself. Snapping out of it, Rodriguez said, all right, he would do it. To celebrate, they all climbed back into the little police clown car and drove off to the Marriott. Taking a suite, they ordered room service and waited for a bigger team from the embassy to arrive. There was, however, one more matter to discuss. In the motel near the airport, Rodriguez had admitted to almost everything. He had talked about the work that he had done for the Cifuentes family. He had described the system he had built, down to its smallest details. He had even, grudgingly, acknowledged building a similar system for someone else, a bigger and more powerful criminal boss. The one thing that he had not yet done was utter Guzman's name. Marston and Potash had never seen fear like this before. They kept going back to the question, gently then firmly explaining that they knew he'd worked for Guzman. All Rodriguez had to do, they said, was just admit it. By now, it was after dark, and they had all been at it for nearly 11 hours, but it was almost as if Rodriguez was choking. He couldn't breathe and was gagging on the name. Eventually, he spat it out like something from his lungs, and as soon as the syllables hit the air, El Chapo, the pressure seemed to lift. Rodriguez looked like he had just expelled a toxin from his body. His breath came back, his shoulders loosened, and he sank into his chair. While Potash sat with him, Marston got up and went to call their bosses in New York. Getting them on the line, he said he couldn't make a promise yet, but it seemed like the Colombian was in. An hour later, they let Rodriguez go for what was now the second time. He had to catch his flight back to Medellin, he said. His family was expecting him. Before the young man left, Potash gave him a private cell phone, pre-installed, with a local Bogota number. He told Rodriguez that he and Marston would be there for a while, and Rodriguez agreed to come back in a day or two to meet them. Then he was gone, forever, Potash feared. After a restless night, Potash woke and sent the text, "Good morning, how are you?" For a long while, too long, there was nothing. Then bloop, there was an answer. "I'm good, how are you?" Potash was also good, exceptionally good. It appeared that the Colombian was definitely in. In the final days of February 2011, FBI confidential source Christian Rodriguez flew by way of Miami from Medellin, Colombia, to New York City for a series of debriefings at the Bureau's Field Division office at 26 Federal Plaza in Manhattan. The interviews, conducted by the sources handling agent Robert Patash of Squad C-23, touched on matters ranging from his professional experience as a hacker and technician to his historical relations with several members of the Cifuentes family, known drug dealers in Colombia. The sessions also included an account of Rodriguez's more recent involvement with Joaquin El Chapo Guzman, a leader of the Sinaloa drug cartel, believed to be hiding in the Sierra Madre Mountains in or near his birthplace village of La Tuna. Rodriguez stated that he had met Guzman on numerous occasions in the mountains, primarily through the auspices of Ildebrando Alex Cifuentes, the Cifuentes family's youngest member. He also attested to building Guzman 3 discrete internet servers as part of an encrypted cell phone system that was used in the furtherance of trafficking activities. Patash did his best to keep Rodriguez calm during the hours they sat talking in the room in Lower Manhattan. But it was clear to him that the young man was a wreck. How could he not have been, caught between the FBI and an international drug lord? In Colombia, Rodriguez said at one point, you couldn't trust the cops. They weren't any better than the traffickers. He eventually confessed that in the small motel near the airport, when they had been staring at the other agent's pistol, he had actually been terrified that they were going to kill him. Patash was distressed, but at least for the moment, he wanted to move things on to the question of next steps, and it seemed that the next steps were going to be difficult. Rodriguez had already thrown a wrench in the machine. While the young technician had acknowledged that he had built the Kingpin secret servers, he also said that he no longer had access to the data they contained. As a technical perfectionist, he had designed his hardware in the most secure fashion, allowing Guzman and his men to set their own passwords without establishing an overriding master code. Even if Rodriguez wanted to, he couldn't just crack into the secret phones at will. Patash had imagined that with Chapo Guzman's personal IT guy at his side, it was going to be easy. All they would have to do was flip a switch, and the intercepts would start rolling in. But clearly, he realized, that wasn't going to happen. It now appeared that they would have to start from scratch and build a whole new system. Rising to the challenge, Rodriguez had a few ideas of how to make it work. For security purposes, he said, his 3 current servers bounced around constantly through different data centers, and whenever he needed to move them, he would tweak the components. If they were going to build new servers, he could simply tell Guzman that he was making another move, and that this time, one of the tweaks required resetting passwords. Then, when they placed the system in its new location, he could insert a script into the network. The script, he explained, would peel the passwords off and quietly send copies to both him and the FBI. Yet again, Patash was impressed, and with a plan in place, he and Marston saw Rodriguez off. The young man was eager to go back to Medellin and get to work. The agents, in the meantime, went about their own work, deciding on a place to house the system once Rodriguez finished it. They both assumed that Guzman would be wary if they moved his servers, which were now located in Canada, to the United States, but if the servers needed to be moved, in order to tweak the system without arousing suspicion, there were several reasons to put them in the Netherlands. The country's combination of strict privacy laws and lax drug statutes would, they theorized, probably appeal to the kingpin. It also didn't hurt that the FBI had a close relationship with the Dutch police's special cyber unit, the high-tech crime team. The HTCT, which had offices and a cutting-edge wire room in Dreibergen, just outside of Utrecht, had long been one of the continent's top online investigative squads. As prosecutors in New York drafted a request to the Dutch, the agent's own squad ginned up a web of fake identities to serve as cover in the public-facing aspects of setting up Rodriguez's new system. When the phony names and credit cards were ready, Marston and Patash used them to rent space at a LeaseWeb server farm in Harlem, a massive complex of generators and satellite antennae large enough that their covert operation would likely go unnoticed. Working with the Justice Department, they sent their letter off to Holland, asking permission for HTCT to tap into the system's three IP addresses, one for the Nokia server, 95.211.10.70, another for the trunk server, 83.149.125.226, and a third for Guzman's BlackBerry's 83.149.125.227. The letter, which effectively performed its legal function, was slender on investigative details. It referred, obscurely, to the confidential source at the heart of the operation as Individual One, and only revealed that he lived in Medellin and had built an encrypted cell phone network for the drug lord, Chapo Guzman. It could easily have taken Rodriguez months to build the network, but working manically at home in Colombia, he completed it in not much more than a week. When Patash saw the final product, he wasn't just impressed this time, he was profoundly impressed. The young man had developed what amounted to a mesh of soft servers hidden in the shell of a hard machine. Only the inner core, a series of Linux virtual devices, was visible to unsuspecting users. No one who didn't know that it was there would even think to look for the external Windows casing. That was the genius of it all. Guzman's other techies, El Gordo and Charlie Martinez, could log into the system the same as always and wouldn't have a clue that the outer digital crust was monitoring everything they did. As long as they didn't check the server logs too closely and catch Rodriguez sneaking through a back door to tinker with the innards, they wouldn't and couldn't figure it out. With the system finished, all that remained was to wait for a moment when Rodriguez could suggest the idea of moving it to the Netherlands. Given how the Kingpin's business worked, it didn't take much time. In early March 2011, one of Guzman's low-level operatives, a man known as El Pariente, was arrested. El Pariente had a phone extension on the current system, and Patash recognized the opening. He told Rodriguez to approach the Kingpin gently and propose a range of security measures in the wake of the arrest. First, he should suggest wiping El Pariente's phone clean, then he should advise updating the system and moving it from its present location. Finally, as an extra precaution, he could recommend resetting all the passwords. It was the young technician's first exposure to working undercover, and though it was fairly simple, no one knew how he would handle it, but helped along by an infallible assistant, Guzman's own distrustful nature, he managed in the end to stumble through just fine. The switch in the Dreibergen wire room was flipped on the morning of April 6, 2011. Within a matter of days, the emails with the intercepts started coming in. C-23 had been waiting months for this, but when Marston and Patash pressed play on the audio files, it all came out as unfathomable chatter. Their translators went to work at once, but no one knew what to listen for at first. Rodriguez helped them pick out Guzman's voice, but even then, whatever he was saying, and he was saying quite a bit, was dense and cryptic, full of references to unknown people and unknowable situations. Well, they were finally in the kingdom and had found it was a crazy maze of unfamiliar rooms and people speaking an impenetrable language. Listening to the intercepts was like passing by a window on the street and catching little snippets from the middle of a conversation between strangers. April 14th, 2011, 7:46 p.m. JGL. That bastard Menyo is abusive. Isn't there a way to get him? Where is he? M10. They have him over there. I believe Felipe has him in Phoenix. JGL. He hurts them from over there? That bastard from all the way over there? M10. No, well, he had a big office. He got them out and put them in the office with the ones from Flaco Salgueiro. Every so often, things made sense. In those halting early weeks, as the Dutch sent more and more emails to New York, Marston and Patash picked up crumbs about ranches in Canada, tunnels in Mexicali and what seemed to be an airstrip in Costa Rica. Guzman, it appeared, was drowning in these details, dealing with an endless string of managerial issues. One of his operatives had recently asked if he could reroute some product from Los Angeles to his customers in Ohio. Another had complained about a new police commander in Durango. The commander wasn't following his orders, and the local team had already been in contact with the governor. Perhaps the boss would consider making a call. The agents were surprised. They had expected someone different. Coarser, tougher, a Mexican Scarface with a booming voice and an abrasive personality. But the man whose calls they were now receiving once or twice a day had a high-pitched, almost whiny accent. He also seemed to be reasonable at times. April 9th, 2011, 2:18 a.m. JGL.
So then you beat up those policemen?
Cholo.
I kicked their asses, the federales, all of them.
JGL.
And what did they tell you?
Cholo.
What are they going to say? They were fucked.
JGL.
Don't be so harsh, Cholo. Take it easy with the police.
Marston and Patash were surprised by something else. There wasn't much on their wire about drugs or drug dealing. The intercepts were filled with office gossip, shocking talk about corruption and salacious prattle about sex. But there weren't many of the usual indicators of a trafficking operation, pickups, drop-offs, or kilos crossing the border. They felt a bit deflated. As drug cops, they were primed to find drugs, and they wondered if they might have missed something or if Guzman had managed to slip one by them. But after hashing it out with their colleagues, it dawned on them that the kingpin wasn't using his encrypted system to run the bulk of his daily operations. The phones were being used for something different, to run the corporate structure of his business. Not that the epiphany helped much with the bosses, some of whom were demanding quick results. There was, in the FBI, a standard way for handling a wiretap. You obtained a warrant, you listened for a while, and then you went into the grand jury and nailed your targets with the evidence. As the resident techie of the squad, Patash found himself having to explain that the system they had set up with Rodriguez was not a standard wiretap. First, he noted, it was exceedingly complex. There were cell phones here, BlackBerries there, Windows was intermixed with Linux, servers were stacked on other servers, and all of them sent and received their data in slightly different ways. Imagine it like this, he heard himself saying more than once. We've designed our own phone system, run by our own phone company. We've put it in a foreign country under totally different laws, and then we've let the bad guys think that they're in charge, when in reality, we've been sneaking in each night, stealing all their calls. And when he put it that way, people usually got it. But even so, the explanation barely scratched the surface of the perils and complexities of keeping the whole thing going. Rodriguez's network, while certainly ingenious, could be glitchy. Marston and Patash had noticed from the start that when they opened some of the emails from the Dutch, the data was garbled and unusable. At other times, they could hear the calls, but only one side of the discussion was recorded. Yeah, on Thursday. No, his cousin's house. The other half was often somewhere else, in a completely different email. To match the separate parts and weave them back together required the techs at ERF to write complicated algorithms. They finally figured out that the system wasn't acting up. It was their partners in the Netherlands. In July 2011, HTCT confessed that they hadn't been collecting Guzman's calls as they were stored inside the servers. Instead, they'd been collecting the calls after they had left the servers. By that point, the network software had already diced the conversations into encrypted bits of data. It was no one's fault. The Dutch police were simply following their laws, which prosecutors had interpreted to mean that only calls in real time and from one phone to another could be captured. To accommodate these laws, Rodriguez came up with a workaround. With his access as the network's administrator, he slipped into the system one night and inserted another script. This script routed everything through a blind, third-party conference call. The conference function was invisible to Guzman and his men, but since it permitted the Dutch to technically take part in the calls, it complied with the restriction of only monitoring live conversations. But even this solution, as savvy as it was not entirely flawless. A few weeks later, Marston and Potash went back to the Dutch with a new request. This time, they wanted HTCT to break into the first two servers, the trunk and cell phone servers, and make full imaged copies of their pre-encrypted contents. That way, they assumed, they would get everything on the network. It took a while for the Dutch to figure out if that sort of hacking was legal in the Netherlands, and even once they determined that it was, they realized that since the first two servers were inextricably connected to the third BlackBerry server, they needed an additional request to copy that one, too. The process started taking so long that Marston and Potash asked for something else, permission for Rodriguez to build another server, one that would copy all the others and store their data as backup. Finally, they thought, all of Guzman's calls would now be legally and technically accessible. All of this, of course, was on top of the risk they ran in getting caught by Guzman's in-house tech team. Maintaining the system was a round-the-clock ordeal. The servers were like heart pumps. If they ever stopped running, or so the New York squad room liked to say, the patient would immediately die. Whenever Rodriguez went into the network to fiddle around with something or implant a line of code, he tried to do so late at night or early in the morning, when Charlie Martinez and El Gordo were likely to be sleeping. If, as he often was, he was making his fixes from New York, he tried to hide his footsteps on a map of anonymous pathways. Rodriguez had inserted a program into a system that would automatically clean the administration logs each night so that no one knew he had been tinkering. But the program wasn't foolproof. One day, he woke up and saw that the auto-erase function had failed. There his login was, from a U.S. address, for anyone to see. When he reached out to Potash in a panic, it was Marston who talked him off the cliff. "Call El Gordo," Marston said. "Call him right now. If he suspects that something's wrong, the last thing he'll do is take your call." Rodriguez called El Gordo, and thankfully, El Gordo took the call. After months of this, the late-night patches, the vexing legal holdups, the working out of various little kinks, the intercept suddenly slowed down. By late August 2011, Guzman's personal calls had already dipped dramatically. Then in December, the rest of the system more or less ground to a total halt. The Dutch, by that point, had sent Marston and Potash nearly 2,000 calls. Minus hangups, about 800 were actual conversations. Of those 800, Guzman himself had been captured on about 200. No investigator in more than 20 years had ever caught the kingpin talking live on 200 individual phone calls. Now, however, just as it seemed like they were finally getting going, he was gone. Sitting in New York, Marston and Potash were befuddled. They didn't understand what was going on. The Guzman they had come to know was a capricious customer, especially when it came to high technology. It often seemed that he was easily bored and was always on the lookout for the latest innovation. Late in the winter of 2011, there were two of those in the communications world, iPhones and BlackBerries. The iPhone had sex appeal. It was shiny, sleek, and sophisticated. The BlackBerry, which the kingpin already had, offered something different: simplicity and security. Most people didn't like to talk on BlackBerries. Instead, they typed their messages by hand. Maybe, the agents mused, Guzman was going through a natural evolution and had moved from the Nokias to different toys and tools. Maybe he didn't want to drive his 87 Honda anymore and wanted something new. Whatever it might be, if he wanted something new, they were going to give it to him. With help from Rodriguez, the agents put together another set of servers designed to work with iPhones. The iPhone servers had all the bells and whistles that the Nokia servers had. Encrypted voice on an encrypted virtual network, with the addition of some new ones, encrypted text and internet. Launching a kind of guerrilla marketing campaign, they had Rodriguez go to Mexico and demonstrate a mock-up of the iPhone for Guzman's techies, Charlie Martinez, and El Gordo. But no matter how ardently the young man promoted the iPhone, Guzman wasn't interested. And a little twist to Operation Server Jack? Alex Cifuentes was. A natural-born hanger-on, Alex had spent much of his life admiring and imitating more formidable men. The chance to have his own private cell phone network, one that resembled Guzman's but was newer and improved, was too much to resist. He took Rodriguez's product almost from the moment it was offered, and as soon as he had the iPhone in his hand, he started texting like a lovesick teenage girl. Scrambling to capture this cyclone of messages, Marston and Patash rushed yet another letter to the Dutch, asking H7C7 to start recording Alex's iPhone servers too. By January 2012, the intercepts on Alex were already pouring in, and it became obvious that despite his glaring flaws, Alex was a major player in Guzman's global empire. He appeared to be in charge of much of the Kingpin's Canadian operations and was deeply enmeshed in his businesses in Ecuador, where his own brother Jorge had worked for several years. It did seem somewhat curious that even though Alex was more or less a glorified assistant, he had his own assistant, Andrea Velez, who, the tap suggested, traveled for him to Canada and Ecuador and was buying all his furniture and bedsheets. Then again, Alex was curious himself. As Marston and Patash soon discovered, he had recently moved to the resort town of Cabo San Lucas, where it appeared he kept a witch doctor on personal retainer. Alex was obsessed with everything occult: UFOs, the Illuminati, pyramids on Mars, paging through his texts about giant aliens or the planet Nibiru may not have been enjoyable, but if it kept them close to Target Guzman, Marston and Patash would do it. That had been the goal all along, to stay close to the Kingpin, get him back. Marston and Patash had already failed to lure him with the iPhones. Now they tried the Blackberries. It was actually Rodriguez's idea. Just before the Dutch had started to spy on Alex, the young technician approached his handlers, mentioning a sensitive, long-term project that Guzman had him working on. Some time ago, he told them, he had been asked to insert malware FlexiSpy onto several Blackberries the Kingpin handed out to his wives and girlfriends. More recently, Rodriguez said, Guzman had come back to him with new instructions to install the spyware onto 30 more devices, not only for the women in his life. The Kingpin had just discovered that one of his top lieutenants, his cousin Juancho Guzman, was an American informant, and that may have triggered his natural paranoia. Now he wanted to avail himself of FlexiSpy to bug his lawyers, his security chiefs, and several of his closest aides. Footnote: Juancho Guzman's body was found by Mexican authorities on December 15, 2011, mouth taped, face down, lying on a dirt road on the outskirts of Culiacan. Several cartel figures later testified that Chapo Guzman had him killed. Marston and Patash immediately recognized the possibilities. The FlexiSpy data Guzman was collecting was invaluable. If they could get their hands on the private texts and physical locations of dozens of people in his innermost circle, it would be like looking at a photograph in negative of the Kingpin's life itself. They jumped into the project straight away. But within a few days, they encountered several roadblocks. FlexiSpy, as they found out, was based in the Seychelles, an island chain in the Indian Ocean that lay beyond the reach of American subpoenas. Moreover, its proprietary data was housed on cloud servers owned by Amazon in Washington State that were managed by a separate firm in Texas known as Cloudflare. Both of the companies told the agents to get lost when they called for help in tracking the data down. Theoretically, the Justice Department could have girded up for a 6-month legal battle and might have even won it. But Marston and Patash were in no mood to wait for litigation. They told Rodriguez to use his access to the program to quietly download Guzman's FlexiSpy files onto the FBI's own Amazon server. Then, with the trove of data in their hands, they asked their prosecutor, Christian Everdell, to submit an application to a judge in New York, begging for permission to inspect it. In late December 2011, the judge came through and Marston and Patash got the go-ahead to pry into Guzman's FlexiSpy accounts. Opening the downloaded files, they were stunned by the raw amount of data, the GPS coordinates alone that Guzman had gathered on the targets of his spying went on and on for pages. FlexiSpy had been tracking their locations for the kingpin down to the decimal degree on an almost hourly basis for a month, and there were dozens of targets in dozens of accounts. 24 hours a day, multiplied by 30 days a month, multiplied by as many as 40 targets, it was tens of thousands of numbers. Guessing there was gold in there, Patash spent that weekend making macros in Excel. When he overlaid the data onto a map, he saw that there were hotspots for Guzman's underlings in two of the usual places, Culiacan, his urban base, and his other favorite hideout, the rugged mountains north and east of the city. And there was a third hotspot, however, in an unexpected place, Cabo San Lucas, where Alex Cifuentes had been living. As overwhelming as the locational data was, it was nothing compared to the written messages they found inside the download. In terms of sheer page numbers, the FlexiSpy texts were even more voluminous, screen after screen of never-ending BlackBerry chats. Through his constant spying, Guzman had amassed an encyclopedia of his crew's communications, and yet they were remarkably obscure. Perhaps the kingpin knew what they meant, but Marston and Patash didn't. 3:26 p.m. My friend here wants to know if you can start talking to the man, that if we buy him a boat, if he would be willing to fish in Los Angeles and willing to receive 200 miles out from San Diego. And as to the material, which one of the small ones or the grass? 3:31 p.m. Of the small ones. It was fairly clear that the people who were sending these messages were talking about drug deals. Unlike the Nokia intercepts, the FlexiSpy chats were filled with constant references to money, merchandise, phone numbers, bank accounts, airplanes, airstrips, factories, and front companies. But it was far from clear who the senders were or what exactly they were doing. All of them were using little code names, Mona, Riris, Hoy, which made it impossible to identify anyone conclusively. Even more confusing, they weren't sending their texts back and forth on ordinary phone numbers. They were using BlackBerry Messenger, or BBM, the company's internal chatting system. BBM swapped chats in a wholly different way based on hard-to-track alphanumeric pins. A photograph was indeed emerging from the data, but it was out of focus. Unlike the voice calls the Dutch had intercepted, the FlexiSpy texts were effectively anonymous. And endless. After Rodriguez got them the first batch of malware downloads in December, there were two more batches in January. Patash tried his best to keep it all straight on his Excel sheets, one for the GPS coordinates, another for the texts. But by early February, he had already amassed nearly 200,000 digital locations for members of Guzman's crew, and enough of their BlackBerry chats to fill a novel. The whole thing, all of it, was madness, a daft game of double-layered espionage. Marston and Patash were spying on the kingpin, even as he spied on large swaths of his own organization. Guzman's jealousy and paranoia had buried the FBI in data. That same month, Marston and Patash caught a break that helped them cut through this morass, and it came from an unlikely place, the DEA. Just as the flood from FlexiSpy was rising past their necks, they got a call from the agency's elite investigative unit in Chantilly, Virginia, the Special Operations Division, or SOD. The guy from SOD had something for them, a BlackBerry pen. A few days earlier, he said a DEA task force officer in San Diego had, as part of a long-term investigation, stopped one of Chapo Guzman's girlfriends at the border as she was passing through the San Ysidro crossing. The officer, Juan Sandoval, had squeezed the girlfriend for information, and fearing arrest, she had given him the pin, claiming it was Guzman's personal number. Sandoval was a solid cop, the SOD guy said, with deep lines into the kingpin's sons, wives, and mistresses. He had immediately sent the number to the embassy in Mexico, but you know how that often went. The embassy got all kinds of crazy shit on Guzman. The BlackBerry pen had made its way back to SOD, and when the unit ran the number through the deconfliction system, which tracked ongoing cases across the federal government, a hit popped up for Marston and Patash in New York. The SOD guy was guessing that the pen might be part of their own long-term investigation, the one the agents had briefed Chantilly on not long ago. Hanging up, Patash went directly to his computer. Opening his Excel sheet of FlexiSpy texts, he hit Alt-F and typed in the digits of the pin he'd just been given. The search function churned and spat back its results as a yellow rash of highlighted splotches. The BlackBerry pin, Guzman's pin, was everywhere in the data. Patash hollered for his translator, and he hurried over to read the highlighted messages. It was intriguing, the translator said. There was no way to be certain, of course, but given the context of who this pin was talking to and the nuance of the slang it used, it could be, if they didn't hold him to anything definitive. Is it him or not? Patash interrupted. Oh, yeah, the translator said. It's totally him. It just made sense. The pin that SOD had sent along often used the not-so-subtle screen name J, and appeared to be in charge of most of the conversations it took part in. Many of these conversations were business conversations, chats about sending pilots on passportless black flights, or incorporating companies in Germany to buy precursor chemicals from China. But some of the chats were personal in nature, and even more revealing. For the next few days, Marston and Patash plugged in Guzman's name wherever the pin appeared, and a whole new world emerged. They read about the kingpin's home renovations and the plastic surgeries he had purchased for his mistresses. There were glimpses of his lawyers, his pilots, his father-in-law, even of his young wife, Emma Coronel, giving voice to their twin infant daughters, Kiki and Emali. 2:07 p.m. I want my little princesses here to fix my meals. 2:08 p.m. Yes, Daddy, what do you want us to make you? Enchiladas? Or maybe it's best if Mommy makes them for you. After all, it was her enchiladas that made you fall in love with her. Surfacing from all of this, Marston and Patash were dazzled. They had jumped into the FlexiSpy data thinking they would come out with a negative of the kingpin. Instead, they had stumbled onto what amounted to a high-resolution color portrait. It simply hadn't occurred to them that the program's malware would have picked up Guzman's own texts, along with those of all of his many targets. But there they were, exposed for all to see, and still stored in the system. The two of them could not believe their luck or his stupidity. In his fits of suspicion, Guzman had managed the impossible. By wiretapping everyone around him, he had accidentally wiretapped himself.